Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, the UGA researcher developing a vaccine for fungal infections.
Fungal organisms are more complex than virus or bacteria, and they have a lot of the same cellular processes as we do.
And we dive into the music of a new Athens voice.
Weekday mornings are a juggle, sometimes even a struggle. Morning Edition from NPR News eases you into your day and keeps you company through the chaos of a busy morning. Hear interviews that give you context on the day's biggest stories, along with reporting and updates on the latest breaking news. Stay on top of the world with Morning Edition every weekday.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Emma Auer. As cold and flu season approaches, we all know the drill. Grab some tissues, hand sanitizer, and maybe get a flu shot. But there's another health threat that doesn't make the headlines: fungal infections. We're used to hearing about viruses and bacteria and the diseases they cause, but fungi are often overlooked. The truth is, severe fungal infections can be deadly, and doctors have only a limited number of treatments to fight them. In this edition of A Few Minutes With, Dr. Karen Norris, the Georgia Research Alliance eminent scholar in immunology and translational biomedicine at the University of Georgia, joins James Hadaway to discuss her pioneering work to develop the first vaccine designed to prevent fungal infections. Here's their conversation.
I thought I might start by asking a fairly broad question, and that is, a lot of people know about viruses, bacteria. How are fungi different as a cause of disease?
Well, these are organisms, and there's multiple different ones that cause infections in humans and also in animals. And these are not as common as we're familiar with viruses and bacteria, but they are prevalent all in the environment. We're all exposed to these organisms, and some portion of the population can get very, very sick from these. And so they have not been as well studied as bacterial infections or viral infections that we're all familiar with. But recently, in the last 2 years, in 2023, the World Health Organization has recognized this, and they came out with a document, which was the first fungal pathogen priority list, to say that this is a global problem that has been understudied and not invested in terms of the research, and that they cause a tremendous amount of illness and death. And I often tell people that these are some of the most important infections and pathogens that you've never heard of.
So what are some of the most common fungal infections? I assume that there are some that are a little bit more everyday, more nuisance fungal infections, but there are also some that, as you already said, can cause very serious disease indeed.
Right. So we sort of group them in two parts, and one is the everyday surface fungal infections that are most common, people are familiar with. But then there are others that we call invasive, and that is they can actually invade in the body and become a systemic infection or even a very serious local infection in the lung, for example. And these are life-threatening infections. These are infections that, even with treatment, the best treatment that we have, can still have a very high mortality rate.
I've read that fungal infections can be particularly dangerous for people with, for example, uncontrolled HIV, or people who might have to take immunosuppressants after they've had an organ transplant. But do you see other vulnerabilities that might predispose someone to a fungal infection?
Yeah, so the most frequent situations for these life-threatening fungal infections are in individuals that have weakened immune systems, either, as you said, from HIV or individuals that have to take medicines that weaken their immune system, like a transplant patient or patients that have certain inflammatory diseases that take immunosuppressive drugs, those individuals are very susceptible to these types of potentially life-threatening infections. And we found other high-risk categories of individuals that include chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes, lung diseases like emphysema, just obesity, chronic liver disease, and so on. And they're not thought of so much as immunosuppressive conditions, but we found a higher frequency of these serious fungal infections in those individuals, as well as the individuals that are profoundly immunosuppressed.
For those people who do contract a fungal infection, whether it's a nuisance infection or whether it's a serious infection, what are some of the current frontline treatments?
Well, there are really just three categories of antifungal drugs as compared to a whole series of drugs that you can use for bacterial infections. So for fungal infections, there are only three categories of approved drugs. And one of the difficulties is fungal organisms are more complex than virus or bacteria. And they have a lot of the same cellular processes as we do because they have the same kind of cells. And so there are fewer targets that would be specific for a fungal organism that would not harm our own cells. So that's what makes it very difficult to treat them. And for some of these individuals that are immunosuppressed, and so we know that they would be susceptible or at high risk, those individuals often get treated prophylactically, so for a long period of time in an effort to prevent them. And that becomes problematic for two reasons. One is these drugs can be toxic over time, and the other is that for any pathogen, bacterial, viral, fungal, if you keep treating the organism or the infection with the same class of drug over and over and over again, the organisms will adapt too, and they will mutate so that they're resistant to that class, that whole class of drugs. One of the big concerns in fungal treatments are the limited choices.
And is this level of drug resistance something that we're seeing more and more in patients?
Absolutely. So there are increase in frequency of drug resistance to one class or two classes or even three classes, and that has increased, you know, in the last decade or so. The other thing that we're finding is that there are emerging fungal pathogens. The most studied and the most evaluated is called Candida auris, and that has been reported in the popular press and newspapers and so on. And that is an organism prevalent in the soil. 10 or 15 years ago, no one knew it as a human pathogen, but it has been isolated from individuals, particularly in high-density populations, so in nursing homes and care facilities and hospitals and so on. And that already came to us as a pathogen with one or two types of drug resistance. So this is an organism that was prevalent in the soil, and it grows in the soil. The soil is typically a lower temperature than our body temperature. This organism has adapted to warmer temperatures, warmer soil, and now it can survive in the human host.
There are a limited number of treatments, but your laboratory is taking a somewhat different track, and your laboratory is developing a vaccine for fungal pathogens. And as I understand it, this is a vaccine that could potentially work against multiple types of fungus. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So the strategy here is to say what we do know, and that is in other aspects of infectious disease, there are antibiotic treatments or antiviral treatments, and there are also vaccines to prevent. Fighting that battle of finding a new target for an antifungal drug when there are limited targets and trying to get that all the way to market, that's a difficult strategy. And from our perspective, the fungal organisms have an advantage. There are multiple fungal pathogens that cause life-threatening illnesses in these susceptible populations. And these populations that are at high risk for these kinds of infection are at risk for several of them, three, four, five different ones. And so it is not possible to make a vaccine to one organism. An individual who is being treated for leukemia and has an immunosuppressive treatment strategy, they are susceptible to infections by an organism called Aspergillus, which causes a lung infection, Candida, which can cause a systemic infection, pneumocystis, which also causes a pneumonia. Any one of those could cause a catastrophic infection. So a vaccine to one of those is not going to move the ball forward, right? So our strategy was to look for something, a target, in fungal pathogens, the most important pathogens that cause the most damage, and say, can we find a target that is common to all of them? And the answer was yes, and so we found one and then said, could we make it so that we can enhance the immune response to this target so that the immune response will target each one of these pathogens if you happen to get exposed to pneumocystis or aspergillus? And that's our strategy. So we call it a pan-fungal, meaning it is across different fungal organisms.
And I understand that you already have seen some pretty significant success in preclinical trials for the pan-fungal vaccine.
We have, and we have published some of those results in scientific journals where we can model invasive candidiasis or pulmonary lung aspergillosis or lung pneumocystis pneumonia. And our vaccine will induce an immune response that protects or prevents sort of the catastrophic life-threatening infections in those situations.
What is the next step for the vaccine that you're developing in your laboratory?
Well, we, in our laboratory, we've done, as you said, the preclinical work, and now we have to work with partners in industry or the government to help us scale up and develop the vaccine so that it is so that we're able to test that in human clinical trials. And like any vaccine, the first test of a vaccine would be what is called a phase one clinical trial, and that's simply a safety trial, which healthy individuals get in immunized with the vaccine, and we look at any kind of positive or potentially negative effects and make sure that that it is safe. So that would be the very next step. And we are working with the NIH, the National Institute of Health, to partner with a company or companies that have the expertise to scale this up and figure out a way to purify it and so on. So those are kind of the next step in the development of it.
Well, I know I speak for everybody when I wish you the very best of luck. Dr. Norris, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us today.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Dr. Karen Norris is the Georgia Research Alliance Eminent Scholar in Immunology and Translational Biomedicine at the University of Georgia. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA.
You can't read the news while you cook or check social media while you drive. So when you need to stay informed but have to multitask, All Things Considered is here. Listen every afternoon from NPR News.
Welcome back to Athens News Matters. I'm Emma Auer. Historic Athens Porch Fest will return for its sixth year this weekend, bringing crowds to the front stoops of seven of the classic city's historic neighborhoods. While some bands are regulars at this free music festival, others are brand new. At 620 Talmadge Drive, the band Crybaby will take the stage for the first time. Heavily influenced by experimental shoegaze music, their indie rock sound is led by front person Asada Belgard. Their previous solo ventures provide a glimpse into the lush soundscape the band will create on Sunday at 6. Bellegarde sat down alongside drummer Robert King and WUGA's Paige Walcott to discuss their upcoming performance. Here's that conversation.
For people that might not be familiar with Crybaby, could you describe your sound?
I'd say it has kind of a feel like a score vibe, like the score of a movie or a show or something. It feels like it tells us, the music itself tells the story that the lyrics are telling.
Yeah.
Which is, and it's a very big sound too.
Mm-hmm.
Anthemic almost.
Also we hear. I'll be with you.
Have any specific influences that you would like to highlight?
I could say like one of the artists I'm inspired by is this group called Life on Venus. They're like a shoegaze group out of, I think, Russia. Probably Glare. They're based out of like Texas.
I just try and make everything sound washy and big and
yeah,
spread out.
Yeah, make it sound good.
Yeah, I try. I mean, obviously, I want to make it sound good.
Yeah.
You guys are both part of multiple bands, but mm-hmm. this is your first time playing Porchfest as Crybabies.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
What does playing Porchfest represent for your journey as artists?
Well, I think it helps us stay connected with the community. And Porchfest mm-hmm. has been around for a long time. And, you know, there's a lot of people that will bring their kids out there, a lot of older folks that don't really go out into the music scene typically, but they'll walk around on a Sunday and watch music all day. It's something that they love, but maybe they don't want to, you know, go to a bar in the middle of the night to go watch music.
Yeah.
So I think it helps, you know, keep us connected with the people that typically, you know, aren't exposed to certain types of music. Yeah. Such as ourselves.
Absolutely. In my eyes, like the mission statement of Crybaby, which is to be like breaking down like emotional barriers. And I think that comes along with, you know, being more, I guess, like empathetic with like family members or getting more, I guess, involved with like people that you typically don't express emotionally to.
Yeah, I also think it's really important for the next generation of musicians, the kids that, you know, mm-hmm. can't make it into the shows because they're underage, right? But they love playing guitar, they love playing drums, and they, you know, they love going to see music, but they don't typically have the opportunity to. So, you know, helping inspire the next wave of artists, I think that's important to me.
Yeah.
Noticing that there's not a lot of people of color on the lineup for Porchfest, can you talk about your experience navigating the Athens music scene as an artist of color?
I do think in a lot of ways it's put me, yeah, just like in rooms that like I otherwise wouldn't have been in. And I think a lot of it has to do with like people knowing that, you know, that I do write good music and do perform well. And so, you know.
Looking ahead, what do you hope people take away from Crybaby's music?
It's kind of my hopes that with listening to like the set that we're going to play, that people, one, like understand that this is a group. They sound good, like baseline. I guess diving more deeper into it, I definitely want to really express that like the deep emotions and like deep feelings that we have, like they're real in a lot of ways, and that like you don't need to cower away about like how you feel about certain things and like the experiences that you have. They are, you know, real and valid, and they should be honored, if not, you know, by others, by definitely by yourself, for sure.
I just wanted to thank you guys for coming out today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having
us. Yeah, this was a great conversation, and I look forward, you know, to seeing you guys play Porchfest.
Yeah.
No, we look forward to playing.
Asada Bellegarde and Robert King are two members of the Athens-based band Crybaby. They'll play during Porchfest on Sunday at 6 p.m. at 620 Talmadge Drive. Music and visual art inspired one another on a recent October evening in Athens, where local musicians Tracy Brown and Jeff Lustig performed jazz and blues for the inaugural session of Music in the House. The new quarterly program invites local musicians to the Linden House Art Center and encourages Athenians to stop by to write, paint, draw, and even shape pottery while soaking in the tunes. Here's this postcard from the first evening of Music in the House.
Done a life drawing in a hot minute, so I actually wasn't sure what to expect. I went into this completely blind, and then when I saw Tracy and Jeff set up, I was like, oh my gosh, this is gonna be an entire musical evening that I can use to inspire my artwork.
But I love the music that they sing, and it really helped relax me, you know. And then it was hard because I had to think of what I wanted to do. But the music, it was really nice to listen to music and paint.
Done this before with other musicians. I go into concerts and I like to use it to springboard my ideas and feed off the environment, and it's just so inspiring.
Tried to get them correct. Beautiful concert. Maybe I'll go home and add some color to it.
Just heard the voices of Amy Patterson, Cindy Meyer, and Bob Clements, Professor Emeritus of Art at the University of Georgia. They attended the first quarterly session of Music in the House at the Linden House Arts Center, where Tracy Brown and Jeff Lustig performed. Music in the House is sponsored by University of Georgia Professor Emerita of Journalism and local novelist Lyra Rhodes. You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia. If you missed a portion of this broadcast, Athens News Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at WUGA.org. And it will be rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8. As always, thanks so much for listening, and stay with WUGA throughout the week for the latest in-depth local news.